This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Hello, everybody, and welcome to CDP's Practical for Your Practice. I'm Corinne Lefkowitz, joined by my podcast pal, Jenna Ermold. Jenna, how you doing?
I'm pleased to be called a pal. You know, I think that's an underutilized term, and I think it's appropriate. A podcast pal is a good place to be.
Plus, it's an alliteration, so it's a bonus.
It is. It really is.
I don't know about you, but I'm pretty excited about our episode today because we have a legend with us, somebody who we've been really eager to get on this podcast. We have Dr. Joe Ruzek with us today to talk about PTSD group treatments. Hello, Joe. Welcome.
Hi. What a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you.
It's kind of like a nice reunion. I mean, we used to all see each other at ISTSS, and it's like the band is back together
trying to make beautiful music.
That's right. Exactly.
I love it. Well, since we've got the band back together, maybe we start by introducing our band member to our listeners. Joe, would you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are?
Yes, I am I guess I would identify myself here as a clinical psychologist, first and foremost. I have been a PTSD specialist across the second half of my career because I was lucky enough to go to work for the Veteran Administration National Center for PTSD. I worked there for 26 years in Palo Alto, California, at the Dissemination and Training Division as a sort of a clinical educator, really. But then, they bumped me upstairs. I was not too good at what I was doing. And I eventually wound up for the last 10 years as the director of the division. So I specialized in things like development of technology for trauma, the dissemination of best practices across the workforce, and also early intervention to prevent PTSD.
So you know a little bit about
just
PTSD.
Just a tad.
I those who cannot do teach. So I hope I know some things, and many things I don't know, but I will tell you the things I do know.
Very modest, as always. Well, Joe, one of the things that we have really been fascinated by or excited about this season is we have this theme, which is what is your why? Really trying to kind of hear the what do we call it, the origin story? I always get that wrong. The psychologist origin story. Like, why did you choose to kind of go into what you did? What is your why for what you continue to do? If you can kind of like tell that origin story to our listeners, that would be amazing.
Well, I think I fell in love with psychology as a young man at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I took a class, believe it or not, on behavior modification at a time before it was not even cognitive behavioral. The hyphen had not shown up yet. It was behavioral psychology. I fell in love with it. And I had, as a lot of young people do, I wanted to do good in the world, and I wanted to help things. And I thought it's a marvelous way of doing it because it seemed to make so much sense. So I thought about what I wanted to, specialize in my career. And I was very interested in bringing psychology, the empirically supported methods, the best science and the best effective techniques, into self-help organizations, into groups. And so my idealistic idea was to create cognitive behavioral self-help organizations. As a young man, I lived for 8 years in London, England, and I started an organization called Drink Watchers. And in Drink Watchers, I ran Drink Watchers groups for many years. So I ran lots and lots and lots of groups. And I became interested in groups, partly as a result of that. Later, when I went to the National Center for PTSD, that was at the time, very famous within the VA as a group residential treatment program. It was the one that everyone came from all over the United States and sometimes the world to visit and see. And they had a lot of milieu therapy, and there were dozens of men, you know, 50 Vietnam veterans with PTSD in a room. And I would run groups for them too. And I ran all different kinds of groups. Out of that experience, I sort of thought that, you know, groups are pretty marvelous things. The magic that happens in a group, the mutual support among people that have been through similar experiences, you know, can't really be recreated between a therapist and a client so much, because, you know, you haven't walked in their shoes and they relate to each other. And I saw that magic, and I realized it could do a lot of things. You know, my interest has never been solely in symptom reduction. It's more in helping people build a better life for themselves. And groups are very good at doing a whole lot of things that individual psychotherapy would find more difficult.
I love that. And that social connectedness that happens in groups amongst people who have had some aspect of a shared experience, and the power behind that. That's fascinating. I didn't know that backstory. So that's really interesting to me.
That's why we ask those questions. We get some really fascinating answers from our guests that we weren't prepared for.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, groups, you see it in lots of different kinds of groups where people that are suffering or dealing with a common difficulty come together. The mutual aid is enormous. You know, groups are interesting. At a time when trauma-focused psychotherapies were very controversial, back 30 years ago, people didn't want to do it. In fact, at that time in the VA, and I think in the Department of Defense as well, there was a belief system moving around that PTSD was a chronic condition that couldn't really be treated. What you needed to do was help people manage their symptoms. And there was a lot of resistance to talking through traumas. At the time, exposure therapy and cognitive processing therapy were not in the VA. And so, you know, what was there were mutual aid, mutual support kinds of things. But I watched the men really bond and connect. And one of the kind of interesting hypotheses, and with cognitive processing therapy, it's been found in some research studies, is that when people work on their traumas in a group, paradoxically, they're sometimes less likely to drop out of treatment than if they're doing it individually, because of the loyalty and the bond that forms between the men or the women. They don't want to let each other down. So oftentimes, the dropout rates, which are a big problem, as you know, in trauma-focused psychotherapy, are reduced by getting people to do these things in groups.
I love all those points. And the first thing that you said reminded me of my very first experience in the VA when I was a lowly practicum student, way back when. And that the message definitely was that PTSD was not a thing that you could recover from. It was a chronic condition. And the best we could do is offer veterans a session a month for the rest of their life and hope we can keep them somewhat stable. So to hear you talking about that evolution is familiar and good to hear. And I also love the way you're talking about the benefits of group therapy, that mutual aid and that loyalty that individuals have to each other. I know you just finished editing a book on group therapies, and I'm curious what you have found, like what's the current state of the research or the knowledge on group therapies in terms of what works and even what doesn't work?
Well, it is a less advanced field in the sense that there's been much less research conducted on groups than on individual psychotherapies. You know, for pretty much obvious reasons, it can be hard to pull together groups. It's more of an enterprise to conduct research on group therapies. There are a number, probably the most of the research that is supportive of group therapies has been conducted on the so-called group versions of the evidence-based individual psychotherapy. So most groups for PTSD are actually adaptations of individual psychotherapies for group environments. Mostly, I think, because of economies of scale. You can simply help more people in a group than you can individually. And that was always one of the reasons why I thought groups are very important. Just to quickly say, the other issue is that many times the impact of trauma and of PTSD symptoms is to create a lot of social problems, interpersonal problems for people, problems with marriages and child raising, problems in affiliating with friends. People become socially isolated, have a lot of problems adapting the workplace, which is so interpersonal. And so groups are very good laboratories for that. But so the probably the most researched interventions are the group versions of some of the individual psychotherapies. For example, cognitive processing therapy has a lot of research. But I would say that overall, the field is under-researched for most particular group interventions. If we're lucky, we have one or two randomized controlled trials, not usually as methodologically strong as the individual treatments. And we have a lot of other suggestive work, you know, pre-post designs and things like that. But more work is needed to establish the efficacy of the groups and also their relative effectiveness compared with other groups and compared with individual psychotherapy. CPT, for example, has done comparative studies of individual and group psychotherapy. And it's probable that if you're trying to reduce PTSD symptoms, individual psychotherapy may well be better. But again, as I've said, there are a lot of other things you want people to gain from treatment experience that probably groups can help with, like the social side of things, increasing sense of trust, helping people learn the skills for reconnecting with other people if they become isolated.
Yeah, there was something you said that really stuck out, which is you called groups as kind of a laboratory to try out those new social connections. And that's exactly what I was thinking as you were chatting, that there have to be other ways to measure the effectiveness of group besides just the reduction of PTSD symptoms, because there are certainly other benefits that come from it that go beyond, you know, a score on a PCL or a PSSI or something.
Well, I personally would see you and raise you, because I think that's a problem with the entire field of PTSD. You know, we've kind of turned into a little bit, you know, of a medical model of all this with our diagnoses, establishing our diagnoses. And there are many ways in which trauma affects people. Certainly, it creates all of the symptoms that we call PTSD, but affects lots and lots of affects people's lives in many, many ways. So really, I think, particularly in group psychotherapy, it's also true of individual psychotherapy, we ought to measure not only reductions in PTSD and depression and that sort of thing, but we ought to measure its impact on their lives. Now, it's common that we'll measure, you know, some index of psychosocial functioning, but we don't measure a lot of detail. We don't really know when we deliver PTSD treatment, what effect it's having on the marriage, what effect it's having on child rearing and parenting, what effect it's having on the formation of friendship relations or the ability of an individual to succeed at work. So there are all of those, we should be measuring the interpersonal outcomes and the life outcomes of PTSD treatment. And I would also say it's one of my personal hobby horses. We should measure the frequency and intensity of positive emotions. We don't want to just reduce bad feelings. When we treat a person for PTSD, are they having more fun experiences, more good, strong, enjoyable emotions, more connections with other people? Is that happening more intensely and more often? It ought to, because that's what having a good life means.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. And I was struck by when you were talking about how we've sort of taken what we know works for individual treatment and we've sort of superimposed that into group treatments. And I was just thinking, as you talked about sort of these groups, you know, is the intention to create more pleasurable experiences, a richer, fuller, more meaningful life? You know, does it, and I apologize, I've not read the book yet, Joe, but, you know, what is one thought that we can sort of do some of the EBPs to sort of target the PTSD symptoms with an adjunct of a group that maybe rounds out these other portions versus superimposing, you know, for example, I'm a PE trainer and PE has some things that are challenging when you talk about doing that in a group. You know, do you see it as a necessary add-on in addition to a, you know, individual EBP? Or you know, how do you, what would be like your, you had a friend or a loved one with PTSD, what would sort of be an optimal course for them if you had your wish?
Well, I think you put your finger on something. I mean, to me, probably for most people, you would want a combination of individual treatment and group involvement, group activities in some way, because they do different things. I think, you know, the job of the counselor or the therapist in a way is to look at an individual person with the person and together decide what are the big ticket items, what are the priorities that they want to work on together, and then assemble a mix of individual and perhaps group interventions to do that. I do think that if part of the goal is to affect the person's ability to function with other people, then the fact that the group creates a kind of a laboratory experiment for the person, a chance to try out new behaviors, a chance to get feedback from peers, much more honest feedback than you would ever get in ordinary conversations. Because ordinarily, you can't find out what another person thinks of you. Even if you ask them for the honest feedback, they will never tell you exactly what they think because it's just too fraught. But in group therapy, with a skilled therapist leading it, the conditions can be created where the feedback is far more frank. And therefore, in the very first time, the feedback might actually be quite useful. And it might get through because it's not just one person either. It's certainly not a psychotherapist right. Who's paid to give you feedback. And who knows what the psychotherapist really thinks. So I think that I would include groups for the interpersonal aspect of it. And also, you know, sometimes groups are really good for just building motivation to work on it and persevere, because as you both know, PTSD treatment is not for the faint-hearted, right? It's not for sissies. It's really difficult because the emotions are the worst emotions in the world that all of us are programmed to try to never have. So we're asking people to do very difficult things. I will just say that, so groups vary, you know, in some main ways. So there are trauma-focused, just as there are trauma-focused psychotherapies, there are trauma-focused groups that do trauma processing, talk through the trauma, open up all the thoughts and feelings and emotions related to traumatic experience in the group. But a lot of groups, probably most groups that clients run into in the ordinary course of things, are more coping skills training groups. They teach them mindfulness, or they teach them stress management, or the coping skill du jour of that the therapist are knowledgeable. That's also very valuable. And sometimes getting involved in coping skills training groups might do additional things over and above what happens when a person works through their trauma. So I think it's an individual matter, and there's no reason that these things couldn't be combined in the best of all worlds, or worked through serially, you know, because, you know, if you do trauma processing work, that doesn't necessarily fix your life. There are other things to do. In the real world, all this is tough because, you know, in most settings, people are paying for psychotherapy. They don't have unlimited resources. Also, therapists are not trained in umpty-ump different group psychotherapies. So a therapist has to make a decision about what to get trained in, what skill sets to try to deliver out of this huge universe of skill sets that everybody is always putting forward.
I think it's interesting because in my mind, I was more of a health psychologist when I was in the Air Force, and that was more of the groups that I ran were more health psychology based. And I feel like there's a lot of similarity there with, you know, the whatever the medical experience, you know, diagnosis and treatment was, you know, that was an individual thing. Like, let's say somebody had cancer, they were working with their oncologist, they were getting their treatment. Some of it was very uncomfortable and all those things. And then the oncology group, you know, supported each other to create a better quality of life and, you know, offer support and tips around, you know, these difficult treatments and what that experience was like, and motivated each other and, you know, did all those things that kind of made that one-on-one medical intervention better. And I feel like it, in some ways that's very similar. I mean, I think when we're talking about it as sort of this, you know, paired thing, but, and I know not all groups are intended to be paired with an individual treatment, but I just think they complement each other so well. And I'm really sort of thinking back on how have we done this for so long without this complementary piece to it. It sort of befuddles me actually now that I'm talking about it.
I think that's right. You know, in my experience, the reason that there was so much group stuff happening is that it was the VA and there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of veterans with PTSD. And so out of necessity in a way, they needed to do a lot of group work, but it's much less common out there in the non-VA world. And if you think about it, it's obvious with somebody with cancer, but I think it should also be obvious with someone who's been through sexual assault or somebody who's been abused as a child or
Absolutely.
World War veteran, that the therapist can do many good things. What they're not going to be able to do so very well is offer a kind of normalization of experience, a transformation of acknowledging what happened to you because it's happened to many other people and that you can see how they're dealing, how I'm dealing. And that feeling of camaraderie and that feeling of support has a depth to it that might be difficult to recreate in all those aspects. And also, I think we would be smart for some types of audiences to have those groups go on and on. You know, why shouldn't people who get to know each other tremendously well in a therapy group, you know, gradually blossom into friendship relationships? And I know in some quarters this would be heresy. I don't really see it that way.
Right,
I think, you know, the thing I didn't do in the VA, which I thought about doing many times, is a big undertaking. I would have liked to create a national alumni program for veterans with PTSD so that they formed friendships and connections and could move forward in time and invite their families. And if they, you know, if they were on business travel and they moved to another city, there would be groups of veterans with PTSD. I think it would have done a lot of good because that's the other reason I became interested in groups, really, quite out of the context of psychotherapy, is to try to create a better society where there are more opportunities for mutual aid and mutual support and connection with other people. And I think groups could do that. And maybe psychotherapy groups do fulfill that function, at least for a period of time with people.
Sure, you get me so excited to tell you about an experience that I had in the VA, and I hope it's okay that I'm not the guest, but I'm going to tell you a clinical story.
Corinne, this is about Joe. This
it's not about me, but it's always about me.
All right, more, you get 2 minutes. Go.
More importantly, it's about my clients in the VA, and I love that notion of an alumni group. A national alumni group sounds wild. I had the opportunity to do that on a small scale level in the VA when I worked there. And it was completely born out of necessity because, like you said, we needed a place to put clients. We needed a place to put veterans, and we were highly encouraged to do whatever we could with a group. So it wasn't that, you know, I was so innovative or brilliant. It's just that I had to find something to do. And so I had this group of my clients who had done with me either CPT or PE individually and then needed to kind of put them somewhere. So this alumni group was born. And, you know, I'm just being really mindful to not disclose anything confidential, but I wish I could tell you details about how wonderfully that group worked, how much these guys, and it was all guys, connected. They did become friends through that group. And in fact, right in my office, I can see it right now, I have a photo that they gave me when I left the VA of where they all got together and went to one of the guys' farms. And they are all smiling, which is not typical to see with our stereotypical Vietnam vets with PTSD. They're all smiling, standing together on this farm. And I had very little to do with that group or the effects of that group. It was them doing that work. So,
and you know what? That's an outcome. That's a treatment outcome, right? And that outcome is not the same thing of, did you know, are you is your physiological arousal level a little lower, or
have your nightmares reduced? Yeah,
but it's hugely important in life. In, you know, that kind of feeling of friendship and good feelings and connections with other people, of being liked by other people, being known by other people, that's worth at least as much, I'd probably more than symptom reduction. So that experience that you describe, I saw a lot in the kind of residential program that we had, which was this massive program. And it's really going to be more the rule than the exception that that kind of thing was created. I'll complain about something, right? So we are kind of sometimes at risk of losing sight of an ability to innovate in this field, because in a lot of healthcare systems now, you know, rightly we focus on, are we helping people with their symptoms? Quite rightly, we need to do that. For a long time, we weren't. But that's not the only objective. So if I wanted to start an alumni group, right, that's not going to look good for my boss, because it's not client contact hours, right? And what are you off doing this whole thing, creating right, this big group of graduates from the program that form a whole community that goes on for the next 25 years, and they help each other and support each other through everything, help each other relapse prevention, make a rich life for each other. You get dinged for that because, that's not in our zeitgeist, our worldview of what therapy is. So there's a, you know, this is another thing about, you know, getting too locked in the medical model of all this kind of thing. But, you know, it's a really big deal. I mean, one of the reasons why I was passionate about the book is I wrote a final chapter in the book on the future of working with people with trauma in group format, because I think there are some very good ways of improving group psychotherapy, which are sort of near term and take group psychotherapy and improve it. But I think, you know, my interests have turned to helping people deal with adversity, disasters, climate change, social conflict, all these things that are pretty noticeable now in our society and are likely to get worse over the next 30, 40 years. And I think that we could do a lot of very innovative things with groups. Can I tell you a couple of my wild ideas? Are you okay with that for a second?
We were kind of hoping you would, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so one idea is that there are a lot of groups in society that are standing groups that people are already in. Those groups are going on for years, and they're going to keep going on for years. Great example are these self-help organizations I've told about. I started to get involved with some groups, women's economic collectives in South India, where impoverished village women would come together economically, and each put in a few rupees every week and have a little bit of a communal bank so they could bail each other out. Now, that group is going to go on for 20 years. Why shouldn't we take our psychological methods, coping skills, training, and other things, and bring them into those groups and give them an additional formal purpose of mastering, improving the well-being of each other and the resistance against the fortunes of life? And so let's take the kinds of things we know how to do, and let's integrate them into groups that exist for other purposes. What's so great about that is these kinds of groups, they go on and on. Those women or those people in that self-organization are going to know each other for 10 years, and they're going to interact with each other hundreds of times. That doesn't happen in psychotherapy. Psychotherapy comes to a hard stop. Let me tell you another kind of group. Each of you, you exist in a social network. You've got friends, you've got family, you've got a boss, you've got an old mentor, you've got a sister-in-law, you have somebody you went to school with 20 years ago. That's who your people are. They're your peeps, right? And why shouldn't we do network interventions? Why shouldn't we pull together networks of friends and family and work with them as a unified group to help them support and shape each other through life. After all, they're going to be working with each other through years. Now, that idea doesn't seem to me to be such an outlandish idea, and yet it's almost never been tried. The only place it's been tried that I'm aware of in society is in the old alcoholic intervention programs, where somebody who was resisting going for treatment, you'd pull together all their friends and family and their boss, and they'd all confront them. But what about if we did that in different ways, where people set goals and let each other know about their dreams and hopes and their problems and trained them, gave them more tools to help one another? So those are really wild ideas. They don't exist, but I hope that somebody listening to your podcast, some young...
wants to fund it.
yeah, and will invent these things and become famous because they're good ideas.
Well, you said, you know, it's not outrageous. It's not an outrageous idea, and yet it's also not obvious. Like you said, no, people aren't doing those things, and yet it makes perfect sense when you describe it.
I'm glad you think that. I don't think either of those things have really been done. And if there's young researchers out there, you can make a whole career on this. And I think they're quite feasible.
Well, that's a pretty good segue, Joe, to get us to towards the end of our episode, to our segment that we call Actionable Intel, where we give some resources to our listeners who either want to get better with group therapies, want to learn more about innovations in group therapies, or want to take on your challenge and actually start implementing some of these new ideas. So if you have some resources or some guidance, we could share them here, and then we'll also include them in the show notes for our episodes. So where can our listeners start?
Well, the first thing is, I think our listeners should start by kind of thinking for themselves whether they want to do it, make a decision to do it. I think I would strongly recommend to every mental health professional that they learn to run groups. It's not so different than doing individual therapy. The skill sets for a group leader and the skill sets for an individual therapist overlap tremendously, and particularly in CBT type groups. But there's an additional skill set that isn't there in individual therapy so much, which is, you know, structuring a group, setting an agenda, moving the group through, like you have artfully moved me through this interview, reinforcing constructive behavior, dealing with people that are talkative, managing conflict in a group, all those kinds of things are slightly different skill sets. And you find a trusty colleague or friend or companion who wants to do it with you, and get busy. You can find a supervisor if you want, but these things it's not rocket science. You can learn to do this and take it on. So number one, go do it. Part of the reason is that the skills that you will develop in running psychotherapeutic groups will be skills that will help you tremendously in your professional career generally, because a lot of those skills are the skills you need to manage a treatment program or to run a team. If you want to be a person who is a boss or is leading teams, then those skills are tremendously important. And oftentimes, if a person who's good clinically, who's got all those kind of really good communication skills and can flow with groups of people, will be a tremendous manager and team leader in other settings. I think that what I would do is, you know, there's such an array of psychotherapies. What I would do is get like the CPT manual, cognitive processing therapy manual, right? Because it's beautifully manualized, you know, the time, things to say, the assignments and everything. And do that, because CPT was designed for group delivery primarily. I mean, it's also an individual treatment, but it's been for many, many years delivered as a group therapy. So that's a good way to learn, because you have a clear model of what to do and it's highly structured. And if you can learn, if you can master CPT, then it's a very short hop to taking on other types of structured groups and running those, as long as you're knowledgeable about the content of the skills you're teaching. I think that for PTSD knowledge, I would always recommend the National Center for PTSD website at www.ptsd.va.gov. I know DOD has great websites, but the National Center one is a vast treasure trove of information of PTSD and a place to go if you haven't gone, you know, make it one of your favorites and snoop around on it. If we are trying to treat PTSD, I would argue that the most important group therapies to master are the trauma-focused group therapies, because they're more likely to have an impact on PTSD symptoms than coping skills groups. Coping skills groups sometimes also reduce PTSD, but the evidence is best for the trauma-focused group versions, right, like CPT. And also, some comparative studies have found that they're more successful in reducing PTSD symptoms. Even such wonderful approaches as dialectical behavior therapy, which is so good at various kinds of coping skills training for emotional regulation, you do not advocate that they be used to treat PTSD in the absence of something that's also trauma-focused. So therefore, it's good to learn PE and CPT or EMDR. And the Medical University of South Carolina, if you go to their website, has great online training in PE and CPT, 10-hour online courses. Now, they're not adequate probably as a training in these things, but they're a very good place to get started and learn. And then I'm not trying to advertise my book, but I would say that if you are interested in groups, it's a pretty good place to look because it's new. So it reviews the various existing major, with a couple of exceptions, most of the major group treatments for PTSD. So you can find out about that. But more importantly, we also put in like about 7 chapters on the nuts and bolts of running groups. So it's kind of a mix between reviewing what's known about group treatment of PTSD and associated problems, but it also lays out how to structure a group, you know, some of the interpersonal skills that are needed, how to evaluate a group, you know, the issues about preparing to organize a group, recruiting people, all those kinds of things are also covered. So it's sort of a little bit of a basic manual on how to set up a group. Those are probably the resources that come to mind. There's no substitute for jumping in with a trustee colleague and getting a mentor, somebody who's done a group, to offer supervision and running a group.
And Joe, you'd be remiss if you didn't name the title or share the title of your book with our listeners.
Well, it's edited by Guilford Press. It's called Group Approaches to Treating Traumatic Stress, a Clinical Handbook, edited by me and Matt Yauch and Chris Berkman. It's a pretty good pragmatic tool, and I think it would help people who want to try their hand at groups. But remember, there are a lot of reasons to get involved in groups, because psychologists need to get out there and try to, you know, change things. And getting the skills for running these groups, even if you don't go out and be, you know, super wild and change the structure of existing groups in society, it'll still be a great skill set to have in your repertoire, and also something you'll find immensely enjoyable.
I really think it's a critical skill. So as you know, our podcast is practical for your practice. And I feel like those recommendations are very practical for our listeners to be able to take next steps. I'm kind of hoping that I might be able to talk you into even doing a longer presentation on running groups, Joe, you know, if I can.
Sure,
promise
my pleasure.
That would be
oh,
great.
Oh, we heard it. It's been recorded.
It's been recorded. It's yep. Documented.
Edited it out, you know.
But anyway, I think those are so many fantastic ideas. We will definitely link all the things in the show notes. Congratulations on the book being published, and really both of us want to thank you so much for taking the time today to walk us through and more importantly, I think, inspire us to be thinking creatively about how we can really broaden. I love broadening the outcomes that we're looking at. I like broadening, you know, how we're delivering some of the existing EBPs, and then really thinking about how can we even marry groups and an individual together. So you've got us thinking. That's what's exciting, right? You know, where can we take this? What kind of communities could we bring this into? So anyway, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you, listeners, for listening in. And we hope to catch you again next time. But thanks again, Joe and Corinne, for a great discussion.
Thank you so much. And good luck to the listeners. I hope it's helpful. And I hope it gets you to go out there and try something new. Thank you.
Absolutely. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
Please feel free to subscribe, like, and share.
Until next time.